Welcome to Public Health Radio. On today's show, I'll be interviewing Barry Levy and Victor Seidel, the joint editors of War and Public Health, a book that explores the effects of military conflicts on public health. Then, in our Viewpoint segment, I will be reviewing the book itself and then discussing its special importance and relevance to Americans. But first, some news from the world of public health. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. In this month's news update, we'll start out with the Centers for Disease Control, the CDC. They released a set of guidelines for schools to use with the goal of preventing unintentional injury, violence, and suicide. The guidelines were developed by the CDC in collaboration with specialists from universities and a number of private and public agencies. Approximately 15,000 young people in the United States between the ages of 5 and 19 years old die from injuries each year, accounting for about two-thirds of all deaths among children and adolescents. These injuries include both intentional injuries, violence, and suicide, as well as unintended injuries such as sports injuries, bicycle and motor vehicle injuries, and drownings. The CDC guidelines include 8 sets of recommendations of actions schools can implement to prevent unintentional injury, violence, and suicide among their students. The 8 guidelines include fostering a safe social and physical environment at the school, safe physical education and recreational programs, inclusion of injury prevention in school health education curricula, quality school counseling and health services, inclusion of staff, parents, and community in the programs, and appropriate crisis and emergency response readiness. These guidelines and the full report are available at the CDC's website, which is cdc.gov. A report from the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, published by the Kaiser Family Foundation, looks at the impact of recent job loss on health insurance coverage. During the year 2001, the unemployment rate rose from 4% to 5.8%. Unfortunately, the same year was one of the worst for health inflation. The cost of employment-based coverage jumped 11%, so that family coverage now averages $7,050 per year across the United States. Based on previous experience here in the U.S., 1.2 million individuals are predicted to lose health insurance coverage for each 1% increase in the unemployment rate. Stated in another way, for every 100 people who lose jobs, 85 individuals will lose insurance coverage. This model assumes some state expansion of Medicaid eligibility. If state-level cutbacks in Medicaid eligibility occur instead, the number of uninsured may be even higher. It is noteworthy that this contrasts sharply with all the other wealthy countries of the world. In all the other developed countries, health insurance is a right of citizenship, so every citizen has health insurance. So in all the other developed countries, no one loses health insurance coverage when they lose a job. Eastern Europe continues to experience the fastest growing HIV epidemic in the world, with the number of new HIV infections rising steeply. In 2001, there were an estimated 250,000 new infections in this region, bringing to 1 million the number of people living with HIV. Given the high levels of other sexually transmitted diseases and the high rates of injection drug use among young people, the epidemic looks set to grow considerably in the near future. Ukraine has the highest prevalence of infection. 1% of the adult population of the Ukraine is HIV infected. The January 9th issue of the Journal of the American Medical Association reports that more Americans are being treated for depression than ever before. The researchers report that the prevalence of depression is probably not changing, but instead a higher proportion of people affected by depression are choosing to seek treatment. This reflects a broadening of public knowledge of the availability of effective treatment and a lessening of the stigma associated with mental health disorders, particularly depression. The increase in the treatment of depression cuts broadly across the population and extends to Hispanics and African Americans, and even to people who are unemployed and uninsured, though Hispanics and African Americans are still far less likely to be treated than the non-Hispanic white population. The researchers compared trends in treatment of outpatients for depression between 1987 and 1997 by analyzing data from a survey of more than 32,000 people in the U.S. In 1987, 7 of every 1,000 people received outpatient treatment for depression. But by 1997, this number had risen to 23 in every 1,000 people. Moreover, 37% of people being treated for depression in 1987 took antidepressant drugs, compared with nearly three-quarters by 1997. On the other hand, the proportion of people receiving counseling and psychotherapy declined during the period. A higher percentage of private insurance plans are providing coverage for medical treatment of depression, but these plans frequently limit the availability of psychotherapy, which costs more than drug treatment. In 1994, the Pan American Health Organization, PAHO, which includes all the countries of the Western Hemisphere, set a goal of interrupting measles transmission by the end of the year 2000. An intensive vaccination campaign was developed. The campaign includes a one-time national catch-up campaign for all children age 1 through 14, routine keep-up vaccinations for infants aged 1 year, and national follow-up campaigns every 3 to 5 years for all children aged 1 through 4 years old. This vaccination program was widely implemented, with vaccination rates above 70% in all countries. The countries with the lowest vaccination rates by the year 2000 were Colombia and Haiti, the only two countries that remained under 80%, and these are, of course, the two countries with the most widespread civil unrest and military conflict. The success of the vaccination campaign has translated promptly into a decline in disease incidence. The number of measles cases has declined from 250,000 in 1990 to only 1,750 by the year 2000, an all-time low. Most of the existing cases reflect a local epidemic in the Dominican Republic and Haiti, and also in Venezuela. The success of the measles eradication campaign is a testament to the effectiveness of international will to improve the public health and excellent levels of cooperation among the involved nations. One area of remaining of concern is the importation of cases from the Eastern Hemisphere, since many countries in Africa and Asia have far larger number of cases and poor vaccination rates than we have achieved in the Western Hemisphere. 775,000 people, mostly children and impoverished families, died of measles in the year 2000. Almost all of these deaths occurred in Africa and Asia. This is Public Health Radio. Our guests today are Barry Levy and Victor Seidel, who together edited the book War on Public Health. The book is available through the American Public Health Association's press at apha.org. Dr. Seidel trained in medicine and public health at the Peter Brigham Hospital, the National Institute of Health, and Harvard University School of Public Health. And he is currently a professor of social medicine at Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York City. Dr. Levy was also trained in medicine and public health, specializing in environmental and occupational health, and is an adjunct professor of community health at Tufts University School of Medicine in Boston. Both of our guests have served as president of the American Public Health Association, and both served in early leadership roles in the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, the organization that went on to win the Nobel Prize for Peace in 1985. Doctors Levy and Seidel, welcome to Public Health Radio.
Pleasure to be with you.
Good to be with you, Marvin.
When people think of public health, the usual concept is the fight against infectious diseases or working on maternal child health or sanitation. On the other hand, issues of war and peace are usually left to diplomats, politicians, or military planners. So tell me, why should public health address the issues of war and peace?
Well,
this is Barry speaking here. Public health is really what we do as a society, as a global society, to assure the conditions in which people can be healthy. And that includes a wide range of things. It certainly does include addressing infectious diseases and maternal and child health and protecting environmental health, but it also has to do with war and violence and other forms of war and other forms of violence. So addressing war is very central to what public health is all about.
Public health is about trying to avoid unnecessary death, disability, and disease. And war has been one of the major causes for civilian death, particularly in this century. At the beginning of the century, of all deaths in war, 14% were 1 in 7 were civilian deaths at the time of World War I. And then in World War II, it became 2/3 of all deaths in war were civilian deaths. And by the end of the century, in Rwanda and former Yugoslavia, 90% of the deaths were civilian deaths. So this is clearly an important and increasingly important topic for public health.
And clearly, so much of, as Vic would say, so much of public health is really about preventing injury and illness, preventing disability, promoting health and well-being in the broadest sense of those words. And war is really anathema to all that.
The movies create an image of war in which there are pitched battles with soldiers shooting at each other. Nobody ever seems to be injured. Either they live through it or they die. And then it's over, and generally the good guys win. Now, obviously that's not realistic, but it does seem that journalists have failed to convey, at least to Americans, what war really means to soldiers and civilian populations. What do you think are the greatest misconceptions in the American imagination about what modern warfare is really like?
Well, I think it relates to the issue of what happens to civilians in wars. Most people still have imageries of World War I, where there were trench warfare, where the soldiers were killed in their trenches or stood up from the trenches to run across the ground. That's what modern war is like, with carpet bombing in World War II, with the kinds of bombing that we've seen in Iraq and now in Afghanistan. Lots of civilians get killed. It's called collateral damage, but there's so much of it that it may even, on one side or another, be a real military tactic to kill civilians.
And not all the bombs that we drop are smart bombs. Many people in the United States have the images from the Persian Gulf War of the bombs that were shown on television, where they hit their mark exactly. Indeed, many of the so-called smart bombs did not hit their mark accurately, and of course many of the other bombs are not set up to be so specific in hitting their targets. In addition, most modern wars are so-called civil wars, and they're fought within countries, and civilians are not only caught in the crossfire, but the whole infrastructure of society is affected. Water supply systems, food distribution, electrical grids, health services, public health programs, all that is affected and disrupted by war.
Another part of that, of course, is the vast number of both internal and external refugees caused by war. If you are forced to move away from your home territory by bombing, by landmines being implanted, by other forms of war, you don't live very long. If you're cut off from your food supplies, you're cut off from your culture, from your society. So part of the impact on civilians is turning them into refugees.
There seems to be a big difference in military tactics between poor entities like guerrilla groups or small countries and the wealthier countries. Russia and Chechnya and the U.S. in several situations start out with massive aerial bombardment, and ground forces only come in later. On the other hand, smaller, poorly funded countries or groups are more likely to use terrorist tactics and make heavy use of landmines. But actually, all those tactics would seem to have a heavy impact on civilians. I was wondering if you could comment on this difference in tactics between the rich and poor countries.
Well, I think you're right. I mean, I think that all that is bad news for civilians, and some of those tactics more directly affect people by they're getting hit by bombs or shrapnel or bullets, and others destroy the infrastructure. And that's something that most people in the United States don't realize. I mean, at some point, the war in Afghanistan will be over, and no matter what the political outcome, there's a vast destruction of the infrastructure there for, you know, all the aspects of it that we talked about a few minutes ago. There's still you know, impacts of the destroyed infrastructure in Iraq as a result of the war there. So, you know, one way or another, virtually all the tactics impact on civilians.
Just to add to that, there's still an impact on the infrastructure in Vietnam following the war and the bombing, with craters, with other kinds of destruction, and so the effects of war last for generations after the kind of war that's now being fought.
The chemicals from you know, various so-called conventional weapons, you know, not to mention the possibility of chemical warfare or biological warfare, but just so-called conventional weapons leave many you know, noxious chemicals in the environment. And as Vic was saying a moment ago, the craters in Vietnam are there from bombs dropped 25, 30 years ago, and those craters now contain water in which mosquitoes breed and carry malaria and other diseases. So there's long-term consequences of war, and most of those consequences are affecting civilians.
Another part of the question that you asked was, when the different ends of the economic spectrum plan their wars in different ways. The United States, of course, has over the past 50 years relied on its nuclear arms to attempt to you know, tell nations what to do in terms of war and peace. Other nations, unable to find nuclear arms, have been using what has been called the poor nations' nuclear arms, and that's weapons of mass destruction of other forms. So you're indeed correct. There's a very different response in nations depending on what their technological and economic capabilities are.
I wanted to compliment you on the pictures you've included in your book, War on Public Health. In fact, before getting further into the book, I wanted to ask you about the cover photo. In the background, there seem to be people milling about almost aimlessly. And then in the foreground is a very thin child, perhaps about 8 years old, staring off into the distance with an almost unreadable facial expression. And this child is almost clutching onto a doll as if to protect the doll from some malevolent force. So who is this child, and how did you decide on this picture for your cover photo?
Well, first of all, the photo was taken by David Parker, who's a physician and photographer in Minnesota, who has gone to a number of places around the world to photograph the impact of war and other forms of social injustice on children. And this particular picture was taken in Sierra Leone in the midst of the civil war there, where people who were fighting killed people or amputated limbs with machetes. And this particular child, I think she's 8 or 9 years old, had her arm cut off by a machete, and she has an artificial arm. And you know, I think you accurately described that. You know, it her face depicts an expression just kind of staring off into space, and I think it captures both the physical impact and impairments and deformities caused by war, but also the strong psychological impact, particularly on children. And, you know, again, another kind of impact that we don't see in the movies in terms of both the physical and psychological impacts on children.
In fact, a great deal of the book, War on Public Health, is about the impact on children because, of course, children have always been a major concern of public health, and it's children who, in the kind of wars that are now being fought, are often the targets of the wars.
Why would children be targeted intentionally?
Some of it is what is termed collateral damage, and children are hurt, are killed, or injured without the enemy meaning to do that. On the other hand, sometimes in war, children are a target. The changes the morale of the situation, the people being fought against if their children are suffering. Some of the bombing that took place in World War II was bombing of civilian populations because that was intended to change the will to resist people. So if they see their kids getting killed, it's one of the reasons they might wish to stop fighting. Some of that may indeed be purposeful rather than simply collateral.
And then there are also special issues related to the effects of modern wars on women. Can you discuss some of these?
Two or three things there. First, in some recent wars, such as the fighting in the Balkans in recent years, women have been specifically targeted, and rape has been a conscious weapon of war, not only in terms of the direct effects on the women who have been raped, but the terrorizing of society that occurs when that takes place. A second effect is that as men go off to fight, women are left behind to tend for their families, and often with very little security. And you know, that's another impact in terms of the burden that it places on women, not only as their husbands or other significant others go off to fight, but when many of them don't return, those women become widows. Other family members may have been killed in the war, so a great deal of both the physical and psychological burden, emotional burden of war falls on women.
Now, you pointed out earlier that many of the modern wars are civil wars. In terms of effects on public health, is there anything special about civil wars as compared to cross-border conflicts?
Well, one of the issues that Vic mentioned earlier is refugees, and there are about 50 million refugees in the world, about half of whom are technically actually refugees who have left their countries, but the others are internal refugees or internally displaced persons who are refugees within their own country, so to speak, without easy access to food or water or medicine or other forms of humanitarian aid. In the Congo, Democratic Republic of the Congo, the International Rescue Committee and others have recently done studies of the civil war that's been going on there in the last few years, which rarely makes the newspapers, much less the front page in the United States. It's been estimated that 2.5 to 3 million people, mostly civilians, have died in that war. It's an ongoing war. Much of that is due to you know, people in the crossfire. Much of it is due to famine and results in malnutrition and disease and death. Much of it is due to medical care and public health services not being available. And, you know, this has all happened without very much of any notice by the United States or other Western nations. So it's a reflection of the fact that so much so many civilian casualties take place, and so little of this is really perceived by you know, the average person, certainly the average American.
On page 14 in the book, there's an absolutely poignant story of a child who's been living in a one-room home. And he's talking to the reporter, and he points to a skull on the floor, and he says to the reporter, "Well, that's my mother." I guess I wanted to let that story, really riveting story, introduce the issue of the mental health impacts of modern warfare.
Well, it's clear that children who've lived through a war bear the scars of that war psychically, psychologically, as well as, of course, physical scars of war. And psychiatrist after psychiatrist, psychologist after psychologist, who've done studies on populations having lived through a war, indicate that the children are particularly hard hit and will never forget, will never outlive the terror, the scenes that they saw during war.
Two or three other related things. Children are often forced into the military to become soldiers, even at age of 10 or 11. This has been true in many wars. It was true in the wars in Southeast Asia, true in a number of the wars in Africa. Children learn, you know, whether they're forced to become soldiers or not, they grow up seeing that violence is the way to settle conflicts. And so it you know orients their whole way of thinking about life and living in a you know living in a war. And indeed, they may be malnourished. They may have chronic diseases as a result of war, in addition to the severe psychological and emotional scars. And they may indeed grow up as orphans because their parents have been killed or died during the war.
In late September, a reporter asked Donald Rumsfeld, our Secretary of Defense, whether he would rule out the use of nuclear weapons in Afghanistan. And he refused to rule out that or any other military tactic. What is your feeling about that statement and how it might be heard in other countries?
Well, it's being heard in other countries, indeed, as a threat to use these weapons. Now, whether that's a fair hearing or not is not clear, because the United States has always taken the position that it does not rule out the use of nuclear weapons in warfare. In fact, when the World Court, the International Court of Justice, dealt with these issues, it said that both the threat of use as well as the use of nuclear weapons are contravened by international law. So we in the book talk about how public healthers need to advance the argument that nuclear weapons should neither be used nor threatened to be used. The fact that Mr. Rumsfeld is adopting the usual United States position as to neither affirm nor deny the possibility of the use of nuclear weapons may have been, you know, enshrined in history, but doesn't make it any more just.
Something that disturbed me about Secretary Rumsfeld's statement was that nuclear and biological weapons really don't have a tactical military use. They are inevitably going to wipe out civilian populations in huge numbers. And I guess it's disturbed me that my country would even consider such a tactic.
Well, it seems to me, if I may for a second, Barry, and then
sure,
chime
yeah.
in on this,
yeah.
That the military can be protected against chemical weapons by gas masks and other kinds of methodology. Military personnel can be protected in certain kinds of ways against biological weapons. When these weapons are used as weapons of mass destruction, they are widespread in their effects, and civilians who are less protected often than military personnel are the ones who get the brunt of them. This is true of nuclear weapons as well, and that's one of the reasons why they're called weapons of mass destruction. They're indiscriminate in their effect, and once they become indiscriminate in their effects, it's civilians who are going to get the brunt of them.
Yes, and I would agree with what Vic said, that there's really no way you can protect civilians adequately against a biologic weapons attack or nuclear attack, and therefore the emphasis really has to be on prevention. And once again, that's a public health way of thinking about things. We need to prevent eliminate the likelihood that there will be a nuclear or biologic weapons attack.
Well, let's take a short break. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Our guests have been Victor Seidel and Barry Levy. We've been discussing their book, War and Public Health. After the break, we'll continue our discussion focusing on some of the indirect impacts of war on human populations. This is Public Health Radio. I'm your host, Marvin Malik. Our guests today are Victor Seidel and Barry Levy, who together edited the book War and Public Health, and that's the topic of our interview today. It's obvious that war has a direct impact on the health of those who are struck by weapons, but your book documents a number of indirect ways that wars can affect the public health. One such side effect is the effect of military conflict on the environment. Can you please comment on that?
Well, Marvin, when we consider environmental effects, and actually some of the other effects we've been talking about, we need to think about not only what happens during war, but in the preparation for war. So we need to think about, for example, the effects on the environment as a result of the production of weapons, as a result of the storage of weapons or weapons-related materials, as a result of the use of non-renewable resources, fossil fuels, for example, or other non-renewable resources by the military. So there's a variety of effects, some of which involve the preparation for war and some of which involve war itself. We all have the images of the oil fires in Kuwait during the Persian Gulf War, and while that was visually spectacular and certainly caused long-term effects on to the environment and to plant and animal life, some of the effects on humans are the things that you can't see, radiation exposure or chemicals entering the groundwater that have been stored improperly. There are places in Russia where territory has been abandoned because the radiation levels are almost 30-fold background levels near the Chelyabinsk nuclear weapons facility. So there are all kinds of effects of radioactive materials, chemical materials, noxious fumes and gases getting into the air, pollution of the water supply that occurs as a result of war. And as we were saying earlier also, some of this represents not necessarily poisoning of the water supply per se, but destruction of the safe water supply such that people with no other alternative need to use water supplies that are known to be contaminated with sewage or chemicals or other other things that cause disease.
In fact, people who write analytically about the environmental effects use the term military operations rather than war, because the military operations, whether in war or in peace, are destructive of the environment. One has only to look at the island of Vieques off Puerto Rico to see what the impact has been in terms of preparation for war by United States Armed Forces, particularly the United States Navy. And that kind of preparation, that kind of expenditure of resources, which robs a civilian economy of some of the resources that it needs, are all the environmental and the health and the economic effects of preparation for war, shorthanded military operations.
Your book catalogs many different types of environmental impacts of war on land use, air, and water. One not especially remarkable statistic speaks volumes. This is from page 120. Let me read it. An F-16 jet taking off for a regular training mission is likely to consume about 3,400 liters of fuel before returning to its base. In less than an hour, the plane thus uses almost twice as much gas as the average U.S. motorist consumes during an entire year. It doesn't seem that being responsible to the environment is actually on the list of priorities that the military views as its mission. Is that your feeling?
I think that's fair to say. Certainly in the midst of wartime, we're creating situations or others are creating situations where the release of chemicals or the use of chemical materials. I'm not talking about chemical warfare here, but incendiary devices and other explosives that contain chemicals in many respects violates the environmental regulations or standards that we adhere to in peacetime.
Well, one good example, of course, was the use of depleted uranium as shell casings during the Persian Gulf War. It turns out that uranium is a very hard metal, and if you encase shells in it and fire them into tanks. Number one, they'll pierce the skin of the tank, and number two, they'll burst into flame once they get inside the tank. Now, the problem is that what remains when depleted uranium is used is a radioactive material, and those who were required to clean up after those events were not all warned. In fact, most of them were not warned about the deleterious effects that the depleted uranium could produce. So you had a lasting environmental impact from the use of a clearly dangerous material, dangerous not only in terms of its killing people, but its long-lasting environmental effect.
Another collateral effect of war is psychological harm, even to those whose families may not have suffered losses. For example, two of the photos in your book portray children. One is a child in Sarajevo, and the other a pair of kids in the U.S. In both cases, they seem to be coddling high-powered weapons. Do you feel that there are harmful psychic effects on people and societies which have chosen to militarize?
Well, you know, there's, I think, several aspects of that. We only need to look at the psychological effects of the terrorist acts on September 11th to the population of the New York City metropolitan area to see what some of the immediate and longer-term psychological effects are on people, you know, reliving certain events and other symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety, and not only anxiety about the violence itself, but anxiety about a number of other related issues, the health and safety of loved ones, the people's overall sense of security, their thoughts about the future, their thoughts about their job. So there are, you know, many things having to do with the violence, and many things having to do with the indirect effects of the violence as well. People's fear for their own safety and for that of their children and their communities. Vic, do you want to say some more about that?
Yeah, another issue here is the modeling that takes place. If children learn that the way you handle conflict is by killing people, by injuring people, by fighting, there becomes very difficult to find other ways of resolving conflict without resort to violence.
Now, there are limits on how much governments can tax their populations, particularly among the poor countries of the world. So military spending represents a diversion of resources from education or health or other social needs. Could you comment on that issue?
Well, for example, in a number of countries that have had long-term civil wars, and actually in a number of countries that haven't been actively at war, a huge amount of government spending goes to the military in contrast to public health and other human services. For example, somebody did a survey a few years back that showed that in a number of countries the amount going to military was 10 or greater fold than to health. In Ethiopia, for example, for every dollar that was spent on health, in all health services and medical services, for every dollar spent on health, the government was spending $16 on military. In Sudan, for every dollar spent on health, the government was spending $25 on military. And many of the much of this military expenditure is for purchasing weapons produced in and sold by the United States.
The United States, indeed, is the largest arms supplier to the world. At one point, when the Soviet Union was in existence, the United States and the Soviet Union were neck and neck in terms of supplying arms to other countries. Now the United States by far leads the world as a supplier of arms, and that not only introduces the dangerous arms, it also robs the nations that buy these arms of resources that the people of those nations need.
And one of the ironies is that these arms have often been turned against the United States. We armed Saddam Hussein in the Iraq-Iran war. We armed or at least trained and supported Osama bin Laden and others in what was originally the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, who were then fighting the Russians or the Soviets. So, you know, it's some of these arms are not only used against innocent civilians within these countries, but Many of them have been used against the United States or against U.S. interests.
Now, I feel that your book definitely succeeds in making the case for the tremendous harmful impact of war on public health. But actually, I was also quite impressed by your book's coverage of the use of public health techniques. Can you describe how the techniques of public health can be applied to the prevention of harmful effects of military conflict?
Well, just so people understand the terms primary, secondary, and tertiary prevention, as they are often used in public health, primary prevention is ultimately preventing something before it happens. Immunization is an example of primary prevention used in other realms of public health. And so its equivalent would be, preventing war itself. And certainly all of us in society, not only health professionals or diplomats or military people and government officials, everyone in society has a responsibility for working to prevent war. The term secondary prevention is usually used to define early detection, mammography screening program to detect and treat breast cancer at an early and hopefully a successfully treatable stage would be an example of secondary prevention. And so applying that same concept to war, one could think of secondary prevention as detecting conflicts at an early stage, maybe even before the shooting or bombing actually breaks out, but to do something at that stage to prevent further evolution of the conflict and to stop it in its tracks, so to speak. And tertiary prevention in public health often refers to treatment and rehabilitation of individuals or groups of people after they've already had an illness or injury. And so adapting the term here, tertiary prevention, has to do with what health professionals and others can do to mitigate or minimize the effects on health of a war that's already broken out, to not only treat injured or ill individuals, but to, for example, provide for basic human needs, provide security to displaced persons, displaced civilians, etc. So that's some examples of how these general public health concepts can be applied to war.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong about this, but it must be that we in the U.S., and as well as most countries abroad, must be spending vastly more money on tertiary prevention activities like rebuilding devastated countries or dealing with massive refugee crises. That must far exceed what we spend to prevent war.
We and other nations so much exceed what is spent on prevention, primary prevention, by treatment, that it is laughable. If the United States had only, over the past 50 years, strengthened the United Nations, worked to find ways to strengthen the Biological Weapons Convention, the Chemical Weapons Convention, now to implement the Landmines Convention, trying to make nuclear weapons illegal under international law, we would at least have had a chance of getting some of these weapons under control. Instead, the expenditure has been to try to defend against these weapons through nonsense like Star Wars, through other kinds of defensive maneuvers rather than preventive maneuvers.
There are other things that we as a nation can do to prevent war and violence. As we mentioned before, so many of the wars nowadays, more than 90% of the wars themselves are civil wars. Most of these civil wars occur because substantial portions of the people in a given country don't have a say, don't have a vote in the major decisions that affect their lives. Many of these civil wars occur because basic human needs are not being met. The same kind of needs that human beings have throughout the world, not only food and water and shelter and clothing, but access to quality medical care, access to public health and preventive health services, opportunities for an education and a decent job, and to preservation and protection of basic human rights. So, the more attention our country and other countries, other more fortunate countries of the world, the more we do to address these issues in other countries, the less likelihood there's going to be war and terrorism that ultimately affects Americans.
I hope that this discussion has sparked an interest among our listeners in learning more about the health impact of military conflict. Can you tell our listeners how to obtain a copy of your book, War and Public Health?
Sure. There are two ways. They can access the American Public Health Association website, which is www.apha.org, and then access the or click on the publications part of the website, or they can call the American Public Health Association in Washington. That number is 202-777-APHA, and ask for the publications department, and they can provide the necessary information on our book, War and Public Health.
And for listeners who may wish to donate or learn more about organizations active in the prevention of war or active in the humanitarian responses to war, can you suggest some?
Well, a couple of things. One is, in the back of our book is a list of organizations that are involved in the prevention of war, in assisting refugees, in addressing some of the issues of social injustice that have led to war, and so forth. There's an appendix of organizations and resources in the back of our book.
Every profession involved in public health has groups that are working to prevent war. There's the American Public Health Association itself, but also Physicians for Social Responsibility, International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, Physicians for Human Rights, a number of nursing organizations.
And there are two other groups, one might add. There are many organizations in this country and in other countries that are connected with various faith community organizations that are providing relief or supporting peace efforts. And finally, there are many organizations dealing particularly with refugees, the American Refugee Committee, the International Rescue Committee, Oxfam America, and others that are providing assistance to refugees.
Well, Dr. Seidel and Dr. Levy, I appreciate your joining us on Public Health Radio, and I hope you'll join us again soon.
Thank you, Marvin. Nice to speak with you.
Pleasure being with you.
On today's show, we listen to Victor Seidel and Barry Levy discuss War and Public Health, a book they co-edited. We occupied the interview discussing the subject matter of the book, but that didn't give the listener a sense of what the book itself is like. Every chapter of the book is written by an expert in the field. The entire book is well written, terse in style, and largely sticks to objective data. These are not editorial pieces. For those seeking further information, each chapter is extensively referenced. The book first analyzes direct human casualties of war, the effects on physical and psychological health, the effects on women and children. It then reviews the predicted types of injuries based on predominant weapons used and how various weapons have predictable effects on civilian populations. The book focuses chapters on nuclear, biological, chemical weapons, and landmines. War and Public Health then goes on to lay out the many types of side effects of modern warfare. Wars produce huge numbers of refugees. Children living in refugee camps may reach adulthood without ever experiencing anything resembling a normal childhood. Then we learn about the devastating effects of warfare on the environment, and how effects on the environment may take decades to overcome, and some effects, such as the dumping of radioactive byproducts of nuclear weapons productions, some effects may be permanent. Several key chapters discuss the diversion of social resources from useful pursuits to the preparation for war. When desperately poor countries pay the salaries of soldiers, bombs, and machine guns, the expense does not help the country to develop. No electricity lines are laid, no food is produced, no roads are built, and no children are immunized. One section of the book provides specific case examples of the effects of military conflict on Central America, Vietnam, and the Persian Gulf. In the final chapters, War on Public Health considers the efforts to prevent and limit military conflict. It provides practical guidelines to explore the science and art of how to anticipate and predict when wars lie months or years ahead, and then how to effectively use the tools of mediation to prevent violent conflict. The chapter written by Michael Renner concerning the role of the United Nations and other international bodies in the prevention of war is essential reading. Finally, the book compiles a useful guide to organizations which are on the forefront of preventing military conflict or mitigating its harmful effects. When I first saw the book at a conference on public health, I was skeptical. I thought to myself that here is another example of public health practitioners extending themselves outside the usual domain of public health. Yes, wars are bad, but why should health workers be any more involved than teachers, businessmen, factory workers, or anyone else? After reading War on Public Health, my skepticism is gone. But another question is whether Americans in particular need to pay attention to this book. Most Americans don't think of themselves as being supporters of war. Surely we are not like the Romans of Augustus Caesar or the Germans of Nazi Germany. In reality, America's record on the issue is decidedly mixed. On some occasions, the U.S. has tried to promote peaceful resolution of international conflict. We have done so in Northern Ireland, in the former Yugoslavia, and we are currently trying to defuse the India-Pakistan conflict over Kashmir. But too often the policies of our country have represented a vast departure from the generosity and kindness that Americans consistently show their neighbors. Often the United States has stood idly by while disastrous wars are begun, when we could be taking the lead in trying to defuse conflict. The U.S. did virtually nothing to prevent the slaughter in Rwanda in 1994, and we are doing very little to de-escalate the disastrous war currently devastating much of Central Africa. Too often, though, our country has actively promoted military conflict. This was not merely the case early in our history in the wars against Native Americans in Mexico, but much more recently as well. The 1980s was an especially bloody period for American foreign policy. During that decade, our country was responsible for financing and encouraging wars in Angola, Afghanistan, Nicaragua, El Salvador, and between Iran and Iraq. Arming the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, who later formed the Taliban government, was the single largest covert military aid project in U.S. history. After our massive expenditures on military aid during the 1980s, we provided virtually no support for humanitarian reconstruction after the war ended in 1989. This led to years of chaos, finally culminating in the Taliban takeover of 1996. In the case of Nicaragua, the 1980s could have been a decade of peace had it not been for the U.S. program of organizing and financing a group of mercenaries based in Honduras who made repeated cross-border forays into Nicaragua, almost exclusively attacking civilians. Thousands of innocent civilians, as well as some international aid workers, lost their lives. Throughout the Iran-Iraq War, a tremendous calamity for the people of those countries, the United States and our allies sold vast quantities of arms to Saddam Hussein, the clear aggressor in that war. Americans may forget that we supported Saddam Hussein for years, including the 8 years of his war with Iran, even though his record as an aggressor and violator of human rights was worse when we supported him than it was after we began to demonize him in 1990. And for several years now, the United States has promoted military solutions to the serious problems in Colombia, the country with the longest-running civil war in this hemisphere, where 40,000 people, mostly civilians, have died in the last decade alone. But nowhere has a relatively casual U.S. attitude toward war had such disastrous consequences as in Angola. After Jonas Savimbi persuaded the Reagan administration that he would fight communism in the southwestern Africa region, the financial spigot was turned on in Washington. Now Savimbi's murderous history is becoming public knowledge only slowly, since it is largely ignored by the press. Well over 1 million people in Angola have died, and development is still largely a dream, since the war continues to simmer, and the country is one of the world's top 5 landmine-ridden countries. Our government had a variety of reasons for fueling these military conflicts. The attempt to cut off the supply of cocaine in Colombia, our grudge against Iran, and the old standby, our crusade against communism. But to give just one example, it is utterly ludicrous to think that a remote, impoverished country like Angola could possibly threaten our democracy. It is just not acceptable or humane for the U.S. to fuel wars in other countries unless there is a motive on the scale of what occurred on September 11th. And especially in the context of the post-September 11th world, we need to be extremely careful about just how and upon whom we initiate military attack. Americans can be a very private people. We have a fiercely independent streak. We prefer to mind our own business and have others do the same toward us. But with the amazing advances in transportation and communication over the last 50 years, the time when it was at all realistic for Americans to ignore the rest of the world was slowly coming to an end. Then, on September 11th, any possibility of U.S. isolation was laid to a final rest, beside the many victims of the terrorist attacks. Much as we might want to, we cannot ignore the rest of the world. Americans have always felt that their democracy should stand as a shining example to the rest of the world, but to most of the world's inhabitants, our policies toward their countries have much more impact on their attitudes toward us than our political and civic freedoms here within the U.S. When we put a military base into a country but don't provide humanitarian aid, it makes a much louder statement than all the elections we hold here in the U.S. in 10 years. How would we feel if soldiers who don't look like us and who speak an alien language took over land in the middle of our country to install a military base? And when a country as influential and technologically advanced and wealthy as the U.S. stands idly by during catastrophic wars, we are not improving our image to the world. There needs to be a good deal more subtlety and morality to our foreign policy than simply protecting the oil supply and rooting out terrorists and illegal drugs. Our foreign policy should better reflect the values of the American people, including their kindness and generosity. Every chapter of War and Public Health makes it clear that a prime focus of our foreign policy should be the prevention and mediation of war. Unfortunately, the content of War and Public Health, the book to which I've devoted this show, is very relevant to Americans in the year 2002. You can obtain the book by contacting the American Public Health Association at apha.org. This is Marvin Malik. I appreciate your joining me for this special edition of Public Health Radio. Thanks for listening, and join us again next time.